succession number 26848, real 8.
Mr. Broomfield, real 8. Now, one thing I want to ask you about, you know, these routine, the covers. What about personal cleanliness? How important was that, and how could you keep clean on one of these little ships?
Personal cleanliness in the Navy was very important, and I'll explain about it. It was part of the discipline. If you didn't keep yourself clean, you could be put on a charge. And I'll give you an example of that. We took on board at one stage a young Belgian who was a coder. No, tell a lie. We took two Belgians. One was a coder, and he was more mature. He'd been in the French Foreign Legion. And the other one was a wireless operator like me. And he used to come on watch with a thick roll neck naval jumper. And he never seemed to wear anything else. And we then realised that he got body odour, because when you went and sat on the seat and took over from him, he left his body odour on the seat. And I thought, I'll tell you, I was very naive when I was in the Navy. I was only 18, as you know. I thought it was just a natural body odour because he was Belgian. And we had a more mature wireless operator who had been in the Glasgow police, and he was very, very pally with the chief, with the petty officer telegraphist, and he spotted that the chap was not washing this Belgium. I hadn't realised it. And the petty officer called him up and said he'd had complaints from the rest of the ratings. And he said, if you don't have regular showers, and I want all your kit washed, I'm going to have a kit inspection tomorrow. And if you're not properly up to the mark, then I'll have you taken on the upper deck and you will be publicly scrubbed. And that's when I realised that personal cleanliness was very important. And most sailors were basically clean people. They were proud to go out with clean shirts and clean uniforms.
Now, what facilities did you have for washing?
Well, we had plenty of water on the ship. We had wash basins. There was hot water while I was on the ship. And there was these buckets that I've just mentioned. And keeping ourselves clean was not really much of a problem.
So there were showers?
There were showers, and sometimes they weren't always available, but I could have a shower with a bucket. They're steel decks, you see, and you could just pour the water over you and it would just run away into the scuppers. So you could have your own shower, and many of us did, rather than go for the showers which were perhaps in use.
Now, what about the latrines? Because, well, the heads.
The toilets were trough toilets. I can't remember how long they were, but say they were about 8 to 10 feet long, and they had slats of wood across like a toilet seat would be, and there was water coming in one end and then flowing constantly, then out at the other end. So you would sit communally. You might have about...
There wasn't dividers between...
No dividers at all. There was no modesty whatsoever. I would think you would have about 6 seats in a line on one side, and you would be facing your opposite number just across the alleyway, and they'd be sitting on their trough closet and you'd be sitting on yours talking to one another, perhaps smoking. And the contents of your bowel would just drop into the trough and then just be scooted down I think it was galvanized steel, and at the bottom. So as far as that was concerned...
And the flow of water was sufficient to...
It was constant, no change to
but
pull.
It was strong enough, the flow.
Oh, yes, it was like a river, and he was just carried away. So they weren't smelly places. They were quite sanitary as far as that's concerned. They were communal, but they didn't allow you any privacy.
How did you... I mean, a lot of, I mean, 18, a lot of people are young and shy.
I was very shy, and still am shy to some extent, but very, very quickly I had that shyness knocked out of me, because it was the only way I could actually deal with the situation. Well, you just had to accept it and deal with it. And it was something that you got used to.
Did it worry at the start? Then?
At the beginning, yes. But once...
Did you try to go when other people were there, that sort
no,
of thing?
No, 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 I didn't do that.
So it was all... But
because the other thing is that you very often had a lot of good humour while you were actually defecating.
Tell me about that.
Well, there were occasions when somebody would sort of... Remember, we'd often be sitting there smoking... he would sort of light a piece of toilet paper and just drop it into the trough, and it would sort of, the idea was to make somebody, you see, you've got your trousers around your ankles, make them jump up and perhaps wet their trousers or whatever. They didn't, but that's basically, the people were larking about. I never saw anybody get bad-tempered about it. It was just generally good humour. But there was no privacy at all.
Now, what about, you know, that when you're on a mess tag, you're in these little things, you're on a 10 days across the Atlantic, was there ever a time when people just got on top of each other?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
We had on board a cinema projector. And very often they would show a film, and most often they would show the film in my mess deck, which was aft. It was actually Vic that used to do this. And
Vic Tizard,
yes, because he was in charge of all the electrical stuff of the ship. And they'd set up a screen, and anybody who was off watch, whoever it was, would come into the mess to see the film.
Now, before we go, I know you're going to tell a story, but let's talk a bit about the film bit first. What sort of films would they have?
They were current films that were on at the cinema.
So full-blown, I mean, not sort of little short black and white.
You'd have to have a break while the reels were changed, but I think they were 16mm films.
Was there any particular type of films that were most popular amongst the lads?
No, they were just normal films that were around in the cinemas.
So gangster films, musicals,
that kind of thing. Yeah, they weren't special to us.
And was this popular?
Yes.
So your mess deck would get pretty full?
Mainly because of the size of the mess deck, you see. Some mess decks were smaller than others, but ours was one that was conveniently sized. And what happened was that my mate, who was a good footballer, and called Bob Bagley, he was moaning when we were having our meal communally with seamen, that why was it always our mess deck that they used for the cinema? Because while they were having the film, he couldn't get his head down, couldn't get to sleep. And one of the seamen, who was pretty thick, I could tell you about him separately, but he had a go at Bob. And they were very nearly going to physically set about one another. But instead of doing that, Bob, who was quite a well-made lad, went to the officer of the day and he said, "Can I have a grudge fight, sir?" And the officer said, "Yes." And what you do, you're allowed to have a grudge fight up on the upper deck with boxing gloves until one gives in, and that's the end of it. It's a way of getting rid of bad tempers. And I remember watching this. This seaman, as I told you, he really was stupid. And he was no match at all for Bob. And eventually he gave in, and that was the end of the matter. And they were both told, any repetition of this and you're both on charge. It was a way of defusing the situation. But it was basically because we were in two watches, and on this 4-hour off, you see, if you were dead tired, you couldn't get your sleep because there's a blooming film on.
Now, would people get niggly with each other anyway? Yes. Besides the films, I just mean, you know, people in the bunk below you, the bunk next to you. That's
not so much on the Spread, more on other ships, actually. But yes, there would be little arguments about different things.
How little?
Oh, even a very small thing would escalate. Perhaps somebody calls somebody a bad word and somebody would pick up on it, things like that.
This wouldn't necessarily go to a grudge fight.
No.
Would this go to an exchange of blows? Or?
Yes. The other thing you need to remember is that all the time that I'm talking and I'm on the ship, I'm very much down the bottom of the heap. I'm only a young sailor. There's other people there who are older than me, more experienced, been in the Navy longer than me, higher rank than me. So there's always somebody about who would say, right, calm it down. And there would be somebody on the mess deck who would be the father of the mess deck, if you like. He would be automatically a respected shipmate. He wouldn't necessarily be senior in rank. He would just be older and somebody that we would listen to. And usually somebody would say, that's enough of that, back that up. You know, I'm getting fed up with that, just leave it alone. So very often it would be your companions roundabouts that would cause it to
sit
on it. There was very little of this business of people actually fighting one another.
Let's look at that. That's the sort of bad side. I don't want to be all relentlessly negative. What about your good friends you made? Now, this Bob, let's look at Bob Bagley.
Yeah.
Now, was he your special pal? What attracted you to him?
I don't know. We were about the same age. We both liked football. Both about the same build. We used to go ashore together. He was on watch with me. I've just told you that he was a good footballer. He was more or less captain of the team. The other thing I'll tell you about him, he could sing. Now, when we used to go ashore, our relaxation there was dancing. People used to go into dance halls, not so much like they do now, but little church halls, wherever.
Even in Liverpool?
Very much so in Liverpool.
Well, tell me, let's move on to a typical visit to a dance hall in Liverpool. What was it like?
It was very often in a church hall, be a little group of musicians. We'd go out at the interval, midway through, get local pub and go and get some beer.
They were dry then, the dances?
The dances were dry, yes. You didn't have any beer in the dances. You'd go out by the interval. But because Bob was a good singer, remember the programmes we're listening to are the American Forces Network, this American band, not the Squadroners, the Glenn Miller, and American programmes, and Bing Crosby. That was the era that I'm talking about, and the Andrews Sisters. And Bob had a good singing voice, and we would go into a dance hall, and if there was a microphone, he would say to the band, would you like me to go on the mic? And they'd say, yeah. And he would go up in his naval uniform, and he would sing a few songs. And he was a good-looking bloke, and he could pull the girls, and he was my mate. And it was very nice to go ashore with Bob, and we were very, very close mates. He used to go ashore, spend all his money and come back skinned, and then he would borrow from me.
You wouldn't go ashore as much?
Not as much. But when I did go ashore, I used to go and have a drink and have a dance.
Would you drink much? What are we talking about?
About 4 pints.
It was beer?
Bitter? Oh, beer, yeah. I didn't touch British in those days. Beer. I didn't get drunk as such, no, paralytic, but I would be quite happy to the point where I would easily sing. I'd be very happy. On the back of me.
What were the pubs like then for a sailor?
Very busy. Packed.
Was there any particular favourites?
In Liverpool. They were only the local ones, more or less, where I live. Because when I go ashore, I go to the borough I lived in, you see. And the
Waterloo.
Waterloo, yeah, yeah. That'd be those pubs there that Bob and I would go into. We didn't spend too much time in them because the interval, say the interval of the dance, it may only be about 20 minutes, half an hour, and we would probably try and get two or three pints in the half hour and then back into the dance, you see, because that's what we wanted to do. We'd sooner dance than drink. It wasn't a pub crawl as such. The drinking was allied to the dancing. And
anything else you'd do ashore in Liverpool? Cinemas?
Sometimes we go to the cinema. Not all that much. We mainly try and find a dance.
Now, I think now we'll move on to the actual Atlantic convoys that you're on for that couple of months out of Liverpool.
Right.
I know you go back to the Atlantic, so there'll be some confusion there. But what do you remember any specific incidents before you moved from Liverpool on the Atlantic convoy?
No. The overwhelming impression of the Atlantic convoys is more or less the sheer boredom of it. Because it was very repetitious. We would pick up a convoy off the coasts of England and eventually escort it across to Canada or America. And we'd even see sometimes the coastline of America, and then we would then exchange our convoy for another one coming out. There'd be an escort group based in America or Canada. And then back we would come. And then when we got back into harbour, we'd be back in the harbour we'd left before, either Plymouth or Portsmouth or Liverpool, wherever it was. And it was very disappointing not to be able to get ashore in these other foreign countries. And I never, ever did get ashore. It was a shuttle service that we were running. And when if you ever got any leave, people say, where have you been? Well, you've been to sea. And all you've seen was the sea. And it, day after day, week after week, it was boring. And you just go on watch, come off watch. And that's my overwhelming impression. It would have been more interesting if we got ashore every now and again abroad. But I was just unfortunate.
No specific incidents that you recall?
Times when we thought we'd got a ping on the Astic and we thought it was a submarine, and we would, drop patterns of depth charges and things like that. But although it was exciting, later on there was an exciting incident where we were fired on by our own ships.
Is that after D-Day, though?
It was on the convoy duties. I can't remember if it was after D-Day or before.
Well, tell us the story then.
What actually happened, it was during the night. I was on duty, and what had happened? No, I wasn't on duty. I was out. We had to go to action stations, and what had happened? We had a bunting tosser. That's a signalman, and he wasn't really on top of the job. In fact, he was dismissed from the ship eventually, and he'd got the recognition signals mixed up, and there was a British destroyer with 6-inch guns, and when she flashed us and got the wrong recognition signal, she fired some star shells over us, and she was treating us as a hostile ship. And we were like in the middle of Piccadilly Circus, was all lit up like a sitting duck. And as these shells were whistling over the top of us, that was quite frightening. And I thought, good Lord, we're going to be sunk by one of our own. Anyway, the yeoman of signals came up, sorted it out. We flashed the proper recognition signals, and all was well. But it was very tense while it lasted. And as I say, this particular chap, he was a friend of mine. He used to often be on watch with me. A very good drawer, But he wasn't up to that particular thing. Something had gone wrong. So that was just one little incident. I saw a number of ships burning in the distance where they'd been picked up, by a submarine and sunk miles away, because these convoys stretch quite a few miles and the ships would be right remote on the horizon, and if something happened, it was quite remote from us. But in the main, I didn't see an awful lot of action. It was mainly boring day-after-day stuff.
So what was the next move? Was it in June? It's when you moved up towards the D-Day operations.
Well, the D-Day one, I think, is worthwhile explaining because there was quite a few interesting things. We had a very good football team on the ship. And Bob Bagley, my pal, he was a very good footballer. I think he used to play for Leeds in Silver Street. Anyway, we had the time when we were waiting to go over to D-Day. We were in the Bristol Channel. Don't know what the why we were there, but that's where we were. And the Nelson, which is the battleship, was not far away. And Bob Bagley went up on our lamp to challenge them to a football match. And nobody answered the lamp. And he came down and told me about it. And I said to him, Bob, you know, that takes a bit of understanding, because there's so many bunting tosses on a big battleship that somebody must have seen it. I went up myself and tried the lamp and just got no response whatsoever. And when I went down to the wireless office, by that time, Petty Officer Story, he'd asked for all the wireless operators to come into the wireless office, and he shoved a rag up the voice pipe to the bridge, melodramatic. And he told us then that D-Day was going to be very, very soon. And the reason that we were up there was to go over the frequencies that he'd been told to use in connection with the communications for D-Day. We weren't told where we were going or anything like that, but we were told it was imminent and we were to get these frequencies sorted out. That's why we were one of the first people on the ship. Then later on, the captain came up on the loudspeakers and they said, right, we'll soon be going into action. And we then set sail from the Bristol Channel round, and obviously we picked up the American forces, because a lot of the Americans were in the west part of England, and we were part of their escort group there. Well, there was a storm, and we had to lay off for a while. We couldn't proceed, because D-Day was postponed because of the storm. And eventually, off we went. And I've never seen anything like it before or since. There were so many ships on the horizon when I came up on deck from time to time. It was just unbelievable. There was thousands of ships sort of business in the channel of all different types. And I saw the big concrete pontoons to do with the harbour at Arromanches and the American one being towed. Had no idea what they were. I just couldn't understand how these big concrete things were actually floating. And we escorted all this lot. At the time, and for about 40 years later, I thought on D-Day that I was actually at Arromanches because of this Mulberry Harbour. And it wasn't until 40 years later when I went to Normandy with my Chief Petty Officer Story, and we were in the American cemetery off Omaha Beach, and he pointed to a map up on the wall and said, well, there you are, there's where the flag was. And we were at Omaha Beach, and because of wartime secrecy, I wasn't told where I was, and it took me 40 years on before I actually realised where I had been.
But what did you see of the landings at Omaha? Well, or were you too far off?
No, I didn't see an awful lot because I was on duty with my earphones in the wireless office. No portholes there. It was only when I came off watch that I could see things. The two abiding memories of D-Day from my point of view is we fired, I think we had 3-inch guns. We fired 3-inch guns for a little while, bombarding the coast. And it wasn't terribly long before we got a signal not to fire any more because our troops had gone a certain amount of into inland. But the big, I thought they were battleships when I looked at them, but I found out since they weren't. They were monitors, the Erebus and the Roberts, two big monitors firing 16-inch guns. And I'd never seen 16-inch guns fired before, and they were very impressive. and we could see the roll of the ship with the recoil of these guns, and they were bombarding for quite a few hours because they had a much greater range. And I was very stimulated by that, because I was glad of the support they were given to the chaps that were trying to get up the beach. I didn't realise they were Americans at the time. I thought they were British, because we were lying off the coast and I hadn't got binoculars. I could only just use my ordinary eyes. We were involved with that. And the weather wasn't too bad. It was in June, and we had one or two days when we were over there that were quite warm. But we had
Where were you based? I mean, you'd left Liverpool. Based on,
well, we were going back. We had started off in the Bristol Channel and took the main stuff across for the D-Day. And then after we were doing convoys back and forth, and going into Portsmouth. So we'd do, say, a 10-day stint, and then back into Portsmouth for refueling things, and then back again onto the convoys. The other memory was, it was a rather strange one, that on one occasion, one day, a storm came after D-Day, a very bad one, and it actually damaged the harbour that was off Omaha Beach, the American harbour, similar to Mulberry Harbour. Apparently they hadn't secured it properly, and it broke up. In fact, it broke up so badly they couldn't use it. That's why we then started to go into Arromanche to use that one. But with this storm, as well as damaging the American harbour, it brought up in some way literally thousands and thousands of jellyfish. I've never ever seen so many jellyfish in my life. As far as the eye could see, they were small, whether it was a breeding ground for them or what, but there were literally thousands of them, if not millions. And I thought to myself, if we do get sunk and we go in the water, we'll be stung to death with jellyfish. And I've never forgotten that. I remember on one occasion we were going, I think we were going into the harbour of Cherbourg when Cherbourg fell, and we had to go in slowly. There were mines about, and they were the type of mines that a ship would go over them, and they would go on a notch, and then all of a sudden they'd come to the surface and hit a ship. There were time to go off at infrequent intervals. And cut a long story short, we were going in slowly, and I heard a hell of a bang. I was actually on watch. And eventually somebody relieved me so I could go and see what was happening. And apparently a British minesweeper was following us in and hit a mine and blew up, and there were no survivors. There was just a bit of debris just floating around by the time I got a chance to go and see what had happened. And that was a very sobering experience.